Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Space Jams podcast. I'm your host, Jim Murphy, and today we have a special guest with us, a former NASA chief historian, Roger Launius. Roger, how are you doing today?
Yeah, I'm just peachy.
Me too. I'm glad. So today we're going to talk about a couple of things. I know you and I talked last week, and we were discussing some stuff about private space, but also we were discussing your time at NASA. And so those are the things we're going to cover today. And just to start it off, we're going to talk about your job, being a chief historian at NASA. And you were the chief historian from 1990 to 2002.
Right.
And well, what does it mean to be a chief historian? What's your job? What's your role?
Well, okay. So let me go back before that a little bit. You know, I finished my PhD at LSU in 1982. And I was studying the history of the American West, particularly Mormonism in the American West. So it was 19th century stuff. It had nothing to do with space flight or anything about flight. But when I finished my degree, I started looking for employment. And the job I ended up taking was as a historian for the U.S. Air Force, a civilian historian, but nonetheless working for the Air Force. And I realized pretty quickly that this air stuff, and it was air in those days, was pretty interesting stuff, even though I hadn't been trained in that. And so I sort of retooled as a historian of technology, and historian of air, and eventually of space. In 1990, after having worked for the Air Force for 8 years, I saw an advertisement. And in those days, it was just a piece of paper that was on a bulletin board at the base where I was working that said that NASA was looking for a chief historian. And I didn't really know quite what that was either at the time. But essentially, it's a person that oversees the effort to preserve, make available, and disseminate the history of the organization. And every federal agency does this. That's what I was doing working for the Air Force. And that's what historians at the Social Security Administration, at Health and Human Services, at the Department of Agriculture, at the Environmental Protection Agency, I could go on and on. At the FBI, they all have historians. And those individuals are charged with that responsibility of collecting, preserving, and making available the history of those organizations. NASA was fulfilling its role along those lines through a centralized office at the NASA headquarters, where there was a small group of people, but nonetheless, a dedicated group that maintained an archive, that sponsored research efforts, that undertook activities to sort of make available the history of the agency. And of course, NASA has one of the greatest histories that anyone can imagine. So it's one that's really cool and fun to do in ways maybe that Social Security Administration might not be. That's a very important activity. People have to do it, but it's not exciting the way NASA is. And so that's what I applied for that job. Lo and behold, I was selected for that position in a competitive search. And at that point, I moved to Washington and began my career working for NASA.
Well, there you go. That's one way to get into NASA right there, being an historian. So that's awesome. Now, along those lines, why do you think it's important that the history of NASA is accessible to the public? I assume that's what it's for. Do you think like it's important that the people know what's going on or know what has gone on, or what's the purpose of it?
Well, absolutely. I mean, the reality is, more so than maybe other entities, but I would suggest to you that other entities have this responsibility as well. You should make available the knowledge about whatever it is you're doing. And in a democratic society such as ours, and with political and governmental institutions, it is absolutely critical that the public be made aware of the things that it does over time. And there's really nothing in my mind that is more significant than that particular agenda. And specifically, and I'll just cite this piece of legislation, the NASA Charter, the National Aeronautics and Space Act of 1958 that created the agency, has a specific statement that says that that it is the responsibility of NASA to preserve and to make available to the widest possible distribution the activities of the organization. And that is the mandate. The legal mandate that NASA has for undertaking historical activities, but also for its public affairs function, for its very open effort to meet and make available information to the public, its educational programs. I could go on and on, but those are all a part of that particular effort to make available to the public knowledge about the organization.
Yeah, I think that's kind of a fascinating thing about history in itself is, you know, we want to collect these things so that the next generation can take something from them, essentially. And I think that even more so with NASA, it's important for the American people. I think it gets the American people, gets young people excited about space for the future. I know that myself, when I'm reading NASA history, I don't think of it as a, you know, a part of a legal agreement. I think of it as a history, a story. And that's super interesting. So it's very exciting.
No question. It's interesting. And NASA's got that exciting history. There's no question about that. I mean, I can't think of a more exciting federal agency to be the historian for. Although, as I said, there are many other historians that are out there in other federal agencies doing their job and doing them well.
And we've talked to one historian on the show. I've talked to a couple of myself, but John M. Logsdon, who's written a couple of books, as you know.
Yeah, I know John very well.
Yeah. So we've talked a little bit with him about space history, and he wasn't necessarily thought of as a historian himself. He was thought of as a journalist. And a lot of space history has happened so recently within the last 60 years or so that it's almost as if people don't count it as history yet. And that I wanted to know what your thoughts on that were.
Well, okay. You know, anything that happened 10 seconds ago, even less than that, a second ago, what I just said is now history. So, you know, anything that has already happened is history. We may think of it more as current events if it's close in time, and we may not have a full appreciation for what has taken place until there's some perspective that is lent by its passage into the past by a few years, but it's still history, and that's significant. There's no question about that. Ultimately, everything is history, and how we deal with that, how we handle that, is a really significant aspect of what it is about our lives and the way in which we approach the world. So I'm just going to tell you this theory and you can make it what you will. I essentially believe that most people divide history, whatever the history happens to be, into three basic sort of concentric circles. The closest is things that they personally remember that they participated in, or that that they have firsthand knowledge of. And that's different for everybody because our lives are all different. But that's history that is history that's very personal. And so, you know, sometimes you will have people who will say, well, I don't remember things that particular way. I remember it in this particular way. And that's their perspective on that historical past. The historical past is the historical past. Their perspective on it may be different than mine. That's okay. That's where the debates over history come in, quite frankly. And it has an immediacy that we can all appreciate. There's a second concentric circle, which is events that have taken place that you don't personally know about, that are not a part of your life, but that people around you have told you about. So for me, that my, you know, my parents were children of the Great Depression, of World War II, those kinds of events they told me about. They don't have the immediacy for me that they did for my parents, but we've all experienced this in the case of, you know, grandparents telling you about whatever. You may have had a grandfather who was in a war who told you about that. You had no firsthand knowledge of it, but you have an immediacy based upon their recollections of it. And then the third sort of concentric circle is everything else. And that everything else, in the truest sense of the term, is history. There are not people there who can recount it for you any longer. There is only the record that exists, whether it be in written form or in the case of early 20th century, 19th century imagery, various other artifacts that you might be able to explore, but there's no firsthand accounts of someone who can tell you about it any longer. And it recedes into the past very, very easily in that context. We are facing right now, for instance, the passing of the Apollo generation. The people who worked on the Apollo program in the 1960s are leaving the scene. Many of the senior folks who were associated with Apollo are already gone. Some of the younger folks who worked in that program in the 1960s, they're retired, and some of them are starting to pass from the scene, to the extent that there will be, in the next 20 years, probably very few people that will remember and have worked in Apollo itself. And that's even true for people who will remember it, who were not working in it. I'm old enough to remember the moon landing. I was 15 when that happened. But in another 20 years or so, I'm 67 now, I would be 87 then. If I'm still around, I may not have any memory left. But 20, 25, 30 years probably max, and the people who remember Apollo will be gone. And it is at that point history in the truest sense of the term. And if we don't preserve it, it's not going to be there. And that's fundamentally what historians are trying to accomplish.
I do like the three camps that you're talking about. I think it makes a lot of sense. And going along the, we're kind of losing the Apollo era. What does it mean when we specifically talk about people who have stepped foot on the moon? What does it mean that we're losing those people on Earth, and we have not, we have plans to go back, but we will, there will most likely be a time where we'll have an Earth where no one has stepped on another celestial body. Like, what does that mean for us as human beings?
Well, I mean, I think that's significant. And, you know, I don't think there's anybody who thought at the time that Apollo 17 took place in 1972, the last landing mission, that it would be this, that this much time would pass before we would go back. You know, we were promised during that Apollo era that, you know, NASA had a long range plan to this effect, that we would create a space station and use that as a spaceport to jump off to create a lunar base of some kind, and a trip to Mars before the end of the century, before the end of the 20th century. We clearly didn't do that, but we didn't think so at the time. And now most of the moonwalkers are gone. There's only a few left, and they'll be passing from the scene in the next few years. Just, you know, the actuarial charts make that a virtual given, and it's unfortunate that we'll lose that touch with the individuals who actually set foot on the moon, who were engaged in the missions to go there. But I know no way around that. We've seen this over and over again. And in the context of where it becomes something that is no longer in the collective memory, and there are no longer eyewitnesses to say anything about it, it is easier for people to then mythologize it and do things with it that don't make sense. We've seen this over and over again. You know, we've seen people deny the Holocaust of World War II. Yeah. And while there are people who witnessed it, who were a part of it, who suffered at the hands of individuals who attempted to exterminate them. They are very powerful voices for what actually happened. And the same is true for those engaged in the Apollo program. But, you know, there's a small community of people out there, but they are a very vocal community. People who say we never landed on the moon. Now, aside from the fact that they're idiots, and I say that consciously, and I'm happy to take any of the barbs that anybody wishes to make along those lines, you know, the eyewitnesses are the very powerful voices who can say, you know, when somebody accosts Buzz Aldrin and says, "You didn't go to the moon," his response was like, "Hell, I didn't." And in one case, punch him out. As he did a number of years ago.
As he should.
I don't disagree. I just hope he didn't hurt his hand.
Yeah.
But the reality is, you know, when that eyewitness is gone from the scene, nobody can make that authoritative statement again. And I'd like to see us get back there soon to look at Tranquility Base and to know that this did indeed happen. There's lots of other ways in which we also know that, but it's, I think, especially powerful argument to be made physically going there and seeing it.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And I think another one that I've been confronted with recently, where things will be soon forgotten, is I was recently at Pearl Harbor. And there's not a lot of survivors of Pearl Harbor that are still alive today.
Almost none.
Yeah. So there's something about losing the eyewitness accounts that is, I think it's, like you said, it's noteworthy. It's very important. And I think especially with having people on the moon, that's huge. And, you know, NASA given promises, the US government given promises that we're going to continue this lunar exploration by the beginning of the 21st century, but it's just been there's been a lot of things going on there. So I guess that's a kind of a good segue into our other conversation that we're going to talk about, where public space versus private space. And do you think that, you know, not going back to the moon since Apollo 17 is a failure of public space, or is it just circumstance?
Yeah, well, okay. I mean, first off, we have to define our terms.
When we say public space,
we're talking about federally funded NASA activities.
Gotcha.
Is what I think we're saying.
Uh-huh.
And that's how I'm treating it. And that has been, right up to today, and will continue to be into the future, the lion's share of activities spent in terms of human spaceflight.
Interesting.
No question about that.
So one of my questions, sorry to cut you off, but one of my questions in the future was going to be, do you think that the baton will be handed to private space and they will take the brunt of the activities in outer space? But we can talk about that one later if you want.
I got lots to say about that subject. Okay.
Awesome.
And the so-called private space is the activities of a few entrepreneurs. And it's, by the way, you know, you can count them on one hand. The people who are willing to invest their money, a significant amount of their money, to create the capabilities to go into space. And so, you know, SpaceX and Virgin Galactic and Blue Origin and places and one or two other organizations are really the only ones that are out there in that category. None of those are really focused at this point in time on going to the moon. They may be focused on doing Earth orbital activities, but most of them are focused on suborbital right now. That's what Virgin Galactic's doing, and that's what Jeff Bezos and Blue Origin's doing right now. But they may shift their focus, but they haven't done it yet. And so those are notable things. I don't speak ill of them at all, except that that's not the future. In terms of lunar activities, not probably in my lifetime. And as I said, I'm 67, so I'm not going to live that long. Maybe in your lifetime, but I plan to be here another 25 years or so, I hope. So the reality is, if there is to be a a concerted effort to return to the moon or to go to Mars, it's going to have to be funded in a way. Well, first off, we're talking about a lot of funding. And we've never figured a way to crack this nut and to break it down into something that is manageable at a private sector level, where there is inherently a conscious decision to make a profit. And you may love space. And clearly, Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk and others who are billionaires do love this space. But is a private sector activity to go to the moon really in the offing, absent a commercial rationale that you can see a return on the investment? That's the bottom line. Exploration, any kind of terrestrial exploration, is built around what I refer to as the three G's. You can use a different set of terms if you wish to do so, but I like to characterize it as the three G's: God, gold, and glory. And the European expansion that took place beginning in the 15th century, and you know, brought Europeans to all corners is the wrong term for a globe, but nonetheless, all the various continents of the world, that was all predicated first on sort of a glory process. Can we physically go and do something and explore? And there were people motivated by that. Do we have bragging rights, either individually or as a nation state? Second, can we make a profit doing it? And in the case of the Spanish, for instance, coming to America, they very quickly realized a profit, because there was all kinds of wealth in the Americas that they were then able to extract, by the way, much of which they took from the people who lived there already. But be that as it may, there was wealth and a return on that investment that was very great, which turned Spain into the greatest nation on earth for a couple of hundred years. And that's remarkable, because we don't think of Spain in that category at all, and haven't for a long time. But in the 1500s, 1600s, and into the 1700s, they were one of the great powers. And what they said and did counted worldwide. So there's the glory part. There's the gold part, extraction of wealth. And then finally, there's the God part, because every explorer that came anywhere they went, the first thing they did was to raise their sword to heaven, claim the territory for the sovereign that they served, and send out the missionaries to deal with the local inhabitants. And we haven't found any local inhabitants on the moon. I don't think there are any there. We haven't found any anywhere else, although it seems almost illogical that you would believe that there is no other entities in the universe that we would encounter at some point in time. And once we do, I can guarantee you that the God part of this will emerge, and there will be missionaries going there. There's a lot of science fiction novels built around that concept, by the way. So the God, gold, glory. This is the process, and the sustaining of that process is only possible with the gold part. Can we find wealth? If we had gone to the moon and found great, lots of things that we wanted, we would have kept going back.
Yep.
We didn't find anything we wanted. Doesn't mean it's not there. Means we didn't find it. But the reality is, without that, we can't close the business case for continuing the effort. And that's why when NASA satisfied the mandate, which was very much a Cold War mandate to go to the moon, it was all about beating the Russians. I cannot emphasize this enough. That's what sparked the Kennedy decision to go to the moon. That's what sustained it throughout the 1960s. And without that, We simply would not have done it on anything approaching the kind of timetable we did and approaching the level of monetary support that we did. It just wouldn't be the case. So having satisfied the mandate, we can check that box and move on to something else, which is exactly what happened in the early 1970s.
True. I love what you're talking about with the science fiction where, you know, finding life on another planet. It reminds me of either Speaker for the Dead, Orson Scott Card, the Ender's Game sequel, or The Sparrow. I forget the Sparrow. I forget what the author, but those are great points. And they kind of made me think, right now it seems as though NASA's goal is exploration. So they're the, or with the three
Gs. One of its goals.
But if we're thinking of the three Gs, I'm thinking private industry, companies like SpaceX and Blue Origin, they're looking for the gold. That's the G for them. They're looking for the gold. And whereas NASA's looking for the God and the glory almost. Because I do believe the search for life is kind of inherently looking for God in a way. We're looking for how we were created or things like that. I kind of find that to be pious in a sense. And you know, you could say that these astronauts are in a way missionaries of human beings. So I think that's super interesting. And I think you talked about before how companies like SpaceX and Blue Origin, you know, they're doing stuff in orbit. You know, they're suborbital or they're in orbit if you're the Crew Dragon program. And I think if we put it into perspective, if Columbus, you know, he was funded by the Spanish king and queen, if Elon Musk's crew, you know, his commercial crew program, his Crew Dragon is funded by NASA, would we count that as a private endeavor or would we count that as a public space?
Well, I mean, that's part of the problem. The vast majority of money spent by NASA throughout its history has been spent on contracts to private sector firms. And for some reason, we don't think of a Boeing or a Lockheed or a Northrop in the same category as a SpaceX, although I would contend we should. And there's really only, the only difference in reality is that SpaceX originated initially with seed money by Elon to build a new launcher. And he blew through that money. He raised some more money. They did build a launcher. And they used a lot of NASA technology in that, but there was no NASA money initially put into it. But with the CC Dev program and a variety of other things at NASA, NASA enticed organizations to expend some of their own resources with some of NASA's money as well to develop these capabilities. And that has been a remarkably successful program. And I was at NASA when that effort first originated. And I will tell you, there's a lot of people at the agency at that point in time who thought it would be an utter failure. And they were looking at the history of how these things had progressed previously. And that's how they reached those conclusions. It wasn't like they just didn't want to do it. They just said, we've been down this road before. It's always failed in the past. Why do we believe it's going to succeed today? And through some strategic investment on NASA's part, through an advance of capabilities in the private sector, and you got to give people like Elon Musk a lot of credit here, a stick-to-itiveness that maybe didn't exist previously, they were able to make it work. And we look back now 20 years, and SpaceX has a going launch capability that they are able to use as a NASA contractor for NASA activities, as a DOD contractor for DOD activities, as a contractor for all kinds of other space launch organizations that need to do something in orbit, communication satellites, you name whatever it happens to be. And that's great. The more providers we have, the better off I think we are. But it's all focused on low Earth orbit. Mm. Or maybe up to geosync, but mostly low Earth orbit. And And there is no market case that can be made as yet for beyond Earth orbit.
True.
Doesn't mean we won't get there, but we're not there yet. So that's still very much a realm that we haven't really exploited in any serious way. And again, I love analogies. I'm a historian. Analogies are basically, you know, the use of history to explain something present tense. So if you think about Columbus, for instance, he had a great idea. And that was, you know, we want to get to China. And that's the bottom line. We want to trade with the Chinese because they've got all these things we want. And of course, we have things that they want. So we got to figure out a trade route that works. And you can do this in a variety of ways. You can go around Africa, you can try to go across country, which was always problematic. Or in Columbus's case, and he didn't realize that the Americas were a big continent between him and China, was okay, well, we'll sail west and we'll eventually get to China. And they knew there was a return on investment if they could get to China. The bottom line was you can't get to China by sailing west without a lot of difficulty. And we never really have done that with the exception of going through the straits around the tip of South America or to take the Northwest Passage. And they spent 400 years really looking for the Northwest Passage, which only in the age of global warming has come to exist.
True.
The bottom line, they had an objective that was commercial.
True.
And had it not been for the Americas that were in the way and discovered by accident, they could have succeeded in doing that. And we don't have that same market concept for the moon, not yet anyway, as a destination.
True, very true. And I think, you know, we talked last week and we kind of came to the conclusion that a lot of people think of space companies as just launchers. So SpaceX, Blue Origin, Virgin Galactic, you know, they're just building rockets, things that access to space. That's what they're building. And, you know, we came to the conclusion that, you know, there's a lot of other companies out there like Bigelow Aerospace, which does inflatable habitats and they do things in, you know, near space. Virgin, Lockheed, Boeing, Sierra Nevada Space Systems, Orbital Sciences, even Garmin. Like these are companies that build things that are working in space, right. You know, satellites and things like that. And that's so important. And I think those are always tossed to the side because there's not as sexy as a rocket going into space or taking people to space, which there's something to be said for. But the other thing, you know, we said NASA looked at SpaceX and they said, we've been down this road. And I did a little research into we've been down this road and kind of what that looks like. And there's far more that I'm going to bring up. But the one I always come back to is the Space Services Incorporated of America in the United States with the Conestoga One. And we were talking about if that was a failed enterprise or not. And, you know, I'm kind of partial to it. I found that it, you know, it kind of bolstered Reagan's idea of kind of making space more accessible to private companies so that we could use our economy to get things into space. But also I found before that, 1975, there was a company started by a man called Lutz Kaiser in Germany called Oltrag. And they also got a privately funded rocket into space. And the whole point of it was they were trying to make an alternative to the Ariane rockets that were being fired off in Europe and the space shuttle. And another notable person that was involved in the Oltrag was the Wernher von Braun, who was the scientific advisor. And so both of these companies eventually were shut down. Oltrag was shut down because it was kind of sent off to, I want to say it was Libya. And eventually it was kind of fizzled out and the technology was stolen away. Things like that. And the SSI really never took off. They both had rockets that got to space, but they never really found a market for
space. Are we talking orbital or are we talking something else?
They got orbital. They were okay. They got over the Kármán line. I believe the Conestoga 1 reached 160 miles, which was...
Okay, was it in orbit?
No.
Okay.
Suborbital, I believe.
So it was a sounding rocket.
It was a sounding rocket, I believe, yes. And so was the Oerdrag. It was they were designed to take things into orbit, take them out there. And so that's what they did. But neither one of them really had any traction. And so I can see where, and they didn't have traction, I believe, because there was no market for these things at the moment. You know, people weren't putting as many things in the space as they are now. So I think that's definitely what SpaceX did was a huge step. And I've always said since, what was it, last July, I believe, is when the Crew Dragon mission went off, Crew 2. I've said the commercial space age has begun. We've kind of left behind the shuttle era and the Soyuz era, and we've entered the commercial space age. I mean, I definitely believe that's true. So
Commercial crew.
And so, and especially now this year, we've had two space companies take people to the above the Kármán line, right below the Kármán line. You know, we've had different areas, but that's also very notable as well. So we've definitely kind of entering this new space age. And I wanted to know, what do you think of the relationship today of the public, you know, public NASA and private companies when it comes to space? Like, how would we define them today?
Well, I mean, I don't think much has changed in the context of NASA from how it's been for the last few years. NASA has the need for certain capabilities, and they have a very clear understanding of what those capabilities are that they want. And they're quite happy to contract for an outside company to provide those services, whatever those services are. If we're talking launch, that's one thing. If it's something else, well, we're talking something else. But NASA is now enjoying the fact that there are more providers out there. Just take the context of space access as an example of that. Instead of, you know, flying on a Delta or an Atlas, for a non-human flight, or a Soyuz for a human flight to the space station. There are other options, and SpaceX is one of those. So is now what used to be Orbital Sciences or Orbital ATK, now a part of Grumman, or Northrop, I guess. Is providing this as well. You know, they can't use Virgin Galactic because they don't have an orbital capability, and that's not what NASA is trying to accomplish with human flight at this point. There are some suborbital activities that might be contracted with to an organization like Virgin Galactic for experimentation, sort of a sounding rocket approach that could be useful down the road, but to my knowledge, they haven't done anything along those lines yet. So the greater number of providers is always a good thing. But I don't see a lot of change happening in the context of the landscape because of the flight of Virgin Galactic or the flight of Bezos and company.
Interesting. Yeah, I kind of disagree where I think that there's going to be a big change. Them sending private citizens to space is not really exploration. They're not moving forward. They're not pressing the issue, but they are getting people excited about the opportunity to get into space. I think the more people get into space, the better, but I definitely agree.
Well, let me push back on that.
Oh, beautiful.
So who's excited about this?
I think people who want to go to space and have.
Okay. So there are people who are already excited.
True.
Okay. So it's not that the numbers has expanded. It's that those who were already interested in this are maybe now a little more interested than they were before. And they come from a certain environment where they have resources to make this possible, to do it themselves. So that's great for those people. This is adventure tourism. And adventure tourism has been around a long time. And there is a small subset of the public worldwide that is willing to expend the kind of resources necessary for a one-of-the-kind sort of experience. And, you know, that includes everything from climbing Mount Everest, which has hundreds of people every year who do this, many of whom do it for the first and only time in their lives, for the bragging rights associated with it, for the glory associated with it. And that's what we're talking about with suborbital space tourism at this point in time. And that's fine. There's no problem with that. If people want to do that, that's perfectly all right. But the price tag is so high, it's going to be a difficult process for the market to expand much beyond that small group of interested people who have the resources available to accomplish it, unless the economics of this goes down significantly. And I don't know when we'll see that happen. Maybe it'll happen in a decade. I doubt it would be much less than that.
I agree with you that it will take a lot of time, but I also think that, you know, Columbus goes to the Americas, he finds native peoples there, he finds this wilderness that is really treacherous. It takes a while to get a lot of people over there, but then, you know, on and on and on, and then we get to the moon.
One big problem with that analogy is Columbus came to the Americas and found all of this wealth.
Yeah, I knew it. I knew you.
And that wealth is what brought all of those adventurers, all the conquistadores, all of those people to the Americas. And they were relatively small numbers, but they were able to extract enormous amounts of wealth. We do not have that with suborbital space tourism.
That's a good point.
There will be people who will pay a fare to do these sorts of things. And that may well be enough to sustain flights at some level and to make a company like Virgin Galactic solvent and create a business model that can be sustained over time. But it's not going to expand it greatly necessarily. And again, unless you can get the economics down to the point where more people can go. You know, if I had the capability to fly and it was half the price of what it is today, I might well do it. And every time you can get that price point down, you're going to find more people are going to be willing to undertake the activity. The other part of this, by the way, is the risk factor. You can have all the money in the world, but if you're going to have a 50-50 chance of dying in the process, there's probably a lot of people who have that money and say, I'm not going to spend it that way. And clearly, there's a risk factor involved. Obviously, it's not a 50-50 chance. We're sure of that, but it's something greater. It's probably in the 90th percentile and above somewhere in terms of the possibility of losing your life.
Yeah, you're still on rocket fuel when you're doing this. So yeah.
This is not Aunt Mabel and Uncle Joe going on a Caribbean cruise.
That's true. But, you know, the Caribbean cruise used to be going out on the open ocean and your ship was made of wood. So things do change. I agree, though.
Therein lies the change in the economics of it and the technology. And if we can get those factors down, clearly it's going to expand the possibilities.
Definitely. Definitely. I think we can agree on that. It's going to take forever. But yeah, I'm excited. And I know that, you know, you're saying that these are all good things and they're, you know, it's fine that they're doing them and all those things. So I can get behind that. I can get behind that.
Well, let's raise one more issue.
Yeah.
I'm with you on all this. I mean, I think it's great that people are doing this. And I don't have any objection to it whatsoever. I don't think it's a large market until we get the economics into a situation where it's within reach of more people. And where the risk factors are down and understood to the level that more people are willing to take the risk. But beyond that, you know, when people think of tourism and space tourism, it conjures up images of honeymooning on the moon and doing things of that nature that are more involved than an up and down flight that's, less than a couple of hours.
True. And I definitely think, with the Artemis program and everything, we're going back to the moon and we're going to make an outpost on them or orbiting the moon with Gateway and things like that. But I'm kind of becoming in the camp where we should be focusing on making the moon colonizing the moon, cultivating the moon, making it a place where humans can live for this exact purpose, having it be the next Americas where people can go and get a job or something or make it more accessible to people. I'm definitely in that boat. I know Elon is all into Mars and things and making us truly interplanetary, but I'm cool with making the moon our next step for large improvements. That would be a very global, but I think that should be probably our next step, looking into those types of things.
Well, that's fair enough. I do believe that the next big step beyond space station should be a lunar base. And I think that base will look a lot like Antarctica.
Yeah.
I suspect it would be multinational in terms of the participants. There may be private sector factors involved in this as well, not just in contracting, but maybe in, modules that are put there at the base for commercial purposes. And that is eminently doable. We can do that. We can cycle people in and out. It'll look a lot like Antarctica. We'll send scientists, technical people, whoever it happens to be up there for some period of time and bring them back. That we can do in the next 20 to 25 years if we choose to do it. But right now, again, this is the return on investment stuff. We have not found a way to extract wealth from the moon.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we will be able to. And this may be the first step in that process. But initially, I suspect it'll look like Antarctica. And it'll be done as a prestige project, just like the bases in Antarctica are by various nations, dedicated to science, doing the kinds of things that they do there. And there's a lot of things that I can see along those realms that might be a possibility. But so let me lay out a scenario for you. So during Apollo, we undertook camping trips to the moon. That's the best way to characterize them. We sent a small group of people. They went there. They took everything with them they needed. They stayed for a little while, and then they came home. We can create this base camp on the moon where we cycle people in and out. They come there, they have a specific set of purposes that they're engaged in, and they stay there for some period of time and they come home. But then there's the challenge of colonization. And it is a real challenge. At the point where you have families go with the intention of living their lives there, of children being born there, of generations coming and going there, and living their entire lives on the moon. It's a different setting altogether. And the problem is not as much technological as it is biological. Every living creature on this planet is evolved to survive at 1G. And it doesn't matter whether they're sea creatures or anything else. It's still 1G. And we personally are evolved to survive at 1G, basically at sea level. We certainly don't do well going down. And we don't do very well climbing up to the tops of mountains without supplemental oxygen and those sorts of things. There are some sectors of society that have evolved a bit. The Andean, the Peruvian, high Andes dwellers who have greater oxygen intake and so on and so forth that makes it possible for them to survive there is a case in point. But the 1G is a real problem. And one of the things that we found in 1/6 gravity on the moon and certainly in microgravity in orbit is that it begins to take hold of the body very, very quickly. And that's why one of the things that happens with astronauts in orbit is they spend hours every day engaged in various types of exercise just to maintain their metabolism, their muscles structure, their bone problems, on and on and on, is an issue. Now, think about that in the context of somebody who's going to live, die, children being born on the moon in 1/6 gravity. There may be factors that we can come up with, ways in which we can mitigate this particular challenge, but it is a challenge. And so I don't think we're going to necessarily see successful colonization of the moon for quite a while, in part because of gravity. The radiation levels are also a problem. So, you know, these nice pictures that we see of domed cities and things like that, well, those people are being nuked every day by radiation from the sun because they do not have the Van Allen radiation belts to protect them. And so the chances are you have to live underground. We can do that, but it's not necessarily all that enjoyable. And there are other factors beyond it. So I think we have to really wrestle with our biology if we're going to try to colonize a place that is strikingly different from Earth.
I love how bleak you make it. It's really wonderful.
I'm not trying to be bleak. I'm trying to be realistic.
I know, which is all and, it's fantastic. It's what people need to hear.
You know, and so I'm going to plug a book here. So my friend Howard McCurdy and I wrote a book in 2008 called Robots in Space. And it's really about the debate over robots versus humans in space. And we've all heard these arguments. You know, is it better to send humans to explore or to send a robot to explore? And there are both sides have their points. No question about that. You know, humans have this great capability to sort of make decisions on the fly and to solve problems very quickly and easily and without, you know, long decision trees or any of those sorts of things. You know, I heard an astronaut say, you know, an astronaut on Mars could do what one of those rovers did in an afternoon. And there's some truth to that because of the ability to sort of make decisions and do stuff. The problem is our bodies are not set up to survive in these very harsh environments. And the robots are more hardy. What's more, they're on suicide missions. We don't care if they come home. You know, the rovers are not coming back from Mars. And that wouldn't be true with astronauts. So you can make the case that in both of these options have good points and bad points. The question is, in the last couple of chapters in this book, ask the question, is the possibility of a merger of humans and machines into a cyborg type of environment the best way to undertake space exploration in the centuries ahead? Maybe. In 1960, a NASA-funded study known as the Cyborg Study by two scientists actually suggested, they asked the question, and this is before the first astronauts had flown, ask the question, is it better to sort of recreate an Earth-like environment in a space capsule or to modify the human body so that they can survive more readily in this environment? And their answer was, I think we can modify the human body. And they undertook experimentation with rats and all kinds of other things to sort of make that, to show the possibilities there. And scared the living daylights out of NASA because, quite frankly, you get into that realm, we're really talking Frankenstein stuff here. Mm-hmm. Or the Borg on Star Trek The Next Generation or whatever you want to focus on. But it's always not good. Yeah. And so NASA just dropped this whole idea in 1963. And there is a cyborg study that's in the NASA Technical Reports server online. You can get it and download it if you wish. And it is fascinating reading. But the question to sort of ask now in the 21st century, as possibilities do exist, is, you know, are there ways in which we might try to do this for long duration space missions with humans, to modify humans so they can survive more effectively somewhere else? We're already becoming cyborgs. It is a truism. How many of us, well, okay, that is not attached to your body yet, but that day will come.
So is
cochlear ear implants, pacemakers in hearts, various things, you know, implants in the brain, which some people have for medical purposes. I could go on and on and on. We're already moving down that road. And what's the next step beyond that? Can we do things that might make it possible for humans to survive more readily in this new environment? Possibly.
Yeah.
But it is a scary proposition.
It is scary. I love the plug of Star Trek there. That was fantastic. But also, you know, there's, you know, Asimov's been contemplating this, you know, with iRobot and things like that. Musk is saying we're already are cyborgs with your phone, and how your phone basically ups your capacity. You don't have to remember as many things because it's in your phone, so you can check your data banks and things like that. He's got the Neuralink going. There's so many different things. And I would argue too, you know, you're saying it's attached to your body. You know, a spacesuit is a type of way to make ourselves a cyborg in a sense, but also I would say that, you know, one of the things NASA is, people don't know this a lot, but one of their, you know, inventions, people always ask, like, why should we invest in space and things? But prosthetics come from a lot of NASA research, right? Things like that.
Yeah, sure.
So that's very, you know, enhancing human structure and things like that. And along those lines, I think that's super interesting. When we're talking about, you know, spacesuits and things, actually, right now, this happened just 2 days ago, I think, but it was said that the Artemis program to go back to the moon by 2024 was going to be pushed back because the funding for the NASA EVA spacesuit was needed like $1 billion more of funding or something like that. And okay. Elon Musk offered to help construct a new spacesuit, essentially, for NASA, which I thought was an interesting thing. It also kind of made me think that the prestige of NASA, as it gets more competitors, the prestige could fall a little bit. Like if companies like SpaceX are building better spacesuits than NASA, what does that mean for NASA? Is that NASA's real purpose? Like SpaceX isn't sending out Voyager 1, Voyager 2. They're not sending Perseverance to Mars yet, but it is something to think about. It made me think about that, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, if he would like to take on the task of building a spacesuit, they have done that, quite frankly.
Yeah.
They're using a different type of suit for Dragon launches. And if he wanted to take on a new EVA suit that could be used on the moon, I'm sure, and he came up with a good design that was readily doable, NASA would be delighted and would contract with his company to produce those for him. But, you know, it's a process. And there's lots of other people who've been working on suits. And some of those ideas are really innovative, and maybe no one of those is going to become the suit moving forward, but maybe ideas from each of them will be incorporated into a suit that will ultimately see widespread use.
True. Very interesting. Yeah. So I suppose there's really only one more area. I mean, we've kind of touched on the future a little bit, but you know, should there be defined roles for, you know, public sector of space like NASA, the ESA and things like that, and private sector of space in the future? Like, should SpaceX, I mean, not touch exploration? Should they stick to essentially being a carrier service? Like I think of SpaceX right now as almost like, they're building buses. They're just building very high-end, high-tech buses to get people from one place to another. Do you think they should be specific roles, or do you think, you know, one could do whatever they want?
Yeah, no, I mean, private sector firm can do what it wants within certain bounds. Obviously, it can't do things that break the law.
Yeah.
I guess it can and get prosecuted in the process. But if it wants to, mount an expedition to the moon or to Mars and is willing to fund it themselves, I think that's, you know, I think that's fine. I think there's very little chance of that happening because of the costs involved. And, you know, we've never, you know, NASA's done multiple studies on what it would undertake, what it would cost to do a return to Mars, or I'm sorry, a return to the moon and a mission to Mars. And they're hundreds of billions of dollars. At best, NASA's Space Exploration Initiative in the 1990s, which was a back to the moon and on to Mars effort, was pegged at $1 trillion. And, you know, that's not the kind of money that, and even if it's half that, that's not the kind of money that one entity is willing to expend on a speculative activity without, especially in a company setting where you have to answer to shareholders or people who have a piece of the company, who don't want you just throwing your money down a rat hole. So what's, you know, what's the return on the investment? If we had a clear sense of there being a return out there, I think there's lots of entities, individuals or companies that would be glad to be engaged in the effort. But until they can see that return, or at least have some sense of how it might unfold within a reasonable amount of time, they're probably not going to be willing to expend large amounts of money to do it.
True. Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. So I guess we started with our definitions. We started out with our definitions. We looked at, you know, what is private space and what is public space. So I guess my question now to kind of end this off here, since we're running out of time, is when, with our definition right now, let me start back. With our definition right now, SpaceX is being funded by NASA to do things for NASA. So they're taking up people to the ISS. They're constructing their Super Heavy. They're constructing the Starship, which will, you know, be one of the human landing systems to go onto the moon. Right now, in your opinion, do you think of them as a pure private space company? And if not, when will they be? What do they have to do to become a pure private space company?
Well, I mean, there's really no such thing as purely private, purely public. I mean,
gotcha.
It never really exists like that. There's always a relationship, and especially in the context of if you're selling services to the government, you're a contractor to the government. Mm-hmm. And that may be a good arrangement for both parties. I'm not debating that part, but it doesn't mean that you're out there just private sector doing whatever you want. You know, you're providing a service to a customer. And that in the case of the government, it's a customer that has very specific requirements, and the desire to look over your shoulder all the time.
Yeah.
And I can't tell you how many people in you name the aerospace company your choice who don't like that, and it doesn't matter whether they like it or not because that's the way it's going to be. Maybe some modification along these lines, depending on an individual contract. But basically, NASA or the DOD or any other entity who is a customer is going to want to make sure that what you're doing is what they want you to do if they're paying for it. And so they're going to provide oversight. And that makes it not purely private by any stretch of the imagination.
Gotcha. There you go. Well, there it is. You know, I don't know how often I get to have a conversation that involves the Borg, NASA, Antarctica, and colonizing the moon, but I'm very glad I had it. So
okay,
we're running out of time here, but just wanted to say thanks again for coming on the show. I had it was a pleasure. I'm glad we got to disagree and agree on certain things. That's always fun.
That's what life's all about.
That's what it's all about. That's what it's all about. There you go. Follow us.
Sometimes you do the hokey pokey.
You got to plug more of your books. You got to do it.
Well, I mean, the most recent one that I would urge people to take a look at is it's called Apollo's Legacy. It's published in 2019. It asks the question, what is the importance of the moon landings? You know, there's chapters on all kinds of interesting things, vicarious exploration, the imagery that came back. That's what that chapter's about, on the decision-making process, the political environment, the astronaut as icon. There's a chapter on the people who say we never landed on the moon and why that has come to pass and how it has evolved over time. So check it out.
Take it from me. The Apollo's Legacy book's really great. Actually, I was gonna tell you when we were talking about the conspiracies, I'm pretty sure I got my idea of all these people having to keep the moon landing a secret. That was from your book, and I thought I came up with it myself, but that's from your book, actually. So there you go. It was a great read. I would definitely check it out. Everybody, we're running out of time here, but remember, I mean, obviously, if you're watching this, we're on YouTube. If you're listening to this, we're on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, other places. Just check us out. One more final thank you to Roger Launius for coming on today. And everybody, always remember to keep looking up.